Let's have an AA meeting.
Let's have one.
My name is Lisa, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speaker Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have the same. So this special person, special lady who I chose to speak tonight means a lot to me. I hope you all get a lot out of her message. I give you Lynette.
Hey family, I'm Lynette and I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
I came in with a boot on my foot. So if y'all see me staggering, y'all know why. It's not because I've had a drink. I want to say this. I am really grateful to be here. And it's not often, well, at one point it seemed like I was on the circuit, that I spoke a lot at one time. You know, a lot of people have asked me at one point, you know, to share my story. It reminded me of when I first came around and I would hear other people share their story. I didn't really think I had anything to share. You know, and the reason why I thought I didn't have anything to share is because I didn't have a long drinking history. First of all, I am going to cut to the chase. Do anyone around here have virgin ears? That's good to hear. Okay. I'm not really a curser. Until maybe after 45, and then I didn't really have the fuck it, but I had the I didn't really give a shit, you know. And I'm kind of, you know, one of those people that they say sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. I was one of those people who was slowly. I'm gonna cut to the chase. What was it like? What happened, and what it's like now. I'm going to pick up where it really starts. Although I'm a product of alcoholics. My mom's an alcoholic. My dad's an alcoholic. A lot of my uncles, my aunties were alcoholics addicts. A lot of people in my family died from alcoholism. And, you know, the crazy part about all that, I even have a picture, matter of fact. I have a picture of me at the age of 12 with the 12 steps and the 12 traditions behind me. I was here making meetings. I'm a product of these rooms to some degree. I was here making meetings with my mom. And I didn't get a lot out of it, of course, because I didn't think it applied to me at all. Secondly, I went to Al-Anon, but it was a lot of stuff going on, but it wasn't spiritual. We was going through puberty. So now, looking back, and it took me a minute, because I'm going to tell you one thing. Although, you know, my sobriety date is 1-3-91. I remember my drinking history as though it was yesterday. It's wild. I thought when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous at the age of 20, I was like, this is like the Twilight Zone. You know, it blew my mind. Because it was like, are you that dumb that you didn't think that you can get this? I picked up my first drink when I was 17. I was a senior in high school. I'm an only child. I did a lot of fighting or defending myself. That's how it started. I did do a little bullying, not to lie. And I learned a lot. You know, I don't think that God does anything in this world by mistake. Nothing. You know, even that photo of me with the 12 steps and the 12 traditions behind me. That was by no mistake. You know, my mom found the picture, and I thought I lost the picture. She was like, make sure you don't lose this picture. And I was like, oh, shit, I lost that picture. Where'd that picture go? So now I keep that picture in my big book. My first drink, I remember it like it was yesterday. I was in a blue light in the basement party. And I was 17 and senior in high school. I was with my drug-selling boyfriend. And I was not very sexually active. I was kind of a nerd in school. Didn't nobody know me by my name. They called me Roxanne. And the reason why that was, if anybody know anything about that song, Roxanne, Roxanne, I want to be your man. You know, we had a Roxanne, we had Apollonia, and we had a Vanity. And I was Roxanne. So, you know, I was not one of those people who was very smart in school. I was making A's in Chicago, but I was a C student at Texas. And the reason why that was because the education in Chicago wasn't worth a damn. You know, if you showed up, you passed. That always made me feel inadequate, because sometimes I remember being in Texas thinking, I really tried. I put my effort in these papers. English was not my favorite subject, but math was my favorite subject. And when I would write my papers, I thought, you know, I got this. I got an A in this. But I was always controversial. So I would always have to go against the grain. That should have been an indicator that, you know, everything wasn't going to be as I planned it. So now, after that party that I went to, I was surprised to find out that when I got home at 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, that I wouldn't be the only one up. My dad didn't have the lights on, none of that. I walked through the door with the key, and I wasn't stumbling, because by this time I had been sleeping. I had a nap before I got there, because when I was drinking, I don't know what the hell they had in that punch. But me and my friend were asleep in the car. But when we came to and I got home, it was a fight, sure enough. You know, me and my dad were like oil and water. Probably because we were a lot alike. He beat my ass that night. I mean, I'm not talking about with a belt. I'm talking about with the back of his hand. I remember crawling out of the living room, trying to get to my bedroom real fast. Because he was just snatching me. He didn't want to hear what happened or anything. And I was like, what about my A's? Do they count for anything? You know, it's not like I'm a regular on this thing, you know. I didn't get any brownie points, none, when I was living with my dad. Now, my mom, on the other hand, she was a sweetheart. But my early years, because I'm going to jump around just a little bit. My early years, when I was 9, I remember thinking about committing suicide. I spent so much time by myself that I thought, why am I here? I was bullied a lot. I didn't want to go to school. This is in, what, elementary school, so on and so forth. I wanted to be like everybody else because they seemed like they was more popular than I was. And I found out that, you know, it wasn't the things that happened to me when I was younger, like the attempts of incest or the molestation stuff. It wasn't because I was pretty. It wasn't because I was smart. It wasn't because I was fine as hell. It wasn't because of none of those things. It was because I was left alone a lot. I remember growing up with a lot of my relatives, a lot of my cousins, because my mom was a partier. She was there. I mean, if it was going on and going down, she was there. And I got to know my family very well. And that's a good thing now today, because I feel like I've been like a sister to everyone, you know. So it's not like my life was easy, but, you know, people had that, well, you're an only child, you're spoiled, you know. You get anything you want and everything you want. But the only thing that I really wanted growing up was my mom's relationship, you know, and her attention and her affection. Didn't know that at the time. I can express myself very well at this age. I couldn't express myself then. I didn't know what it was. I just got used to it. You know, I didn't know what dysfunction was. So when I got to be older, I thought, you know, senior in high school, I didn't have the support of anybody saying, you know, you need to go to college and this is how you do it. And I didn't get that. I mean, even my dad was like, I don't know, why are you taking the SATs? You're not going to pass. Because I barely passed myself. So I had low self-esteem, you know, off the rip. But I was a loner as well. What I learned, because I think that every experience was a learning experience for me. What I learned was a lot of strategies on how to protect myself. I was one of those girls who didn't have a problem with other girls talking about me. As long as they didn't put their hands on me, we were good. So can you imagine a troop of girls walking behind you, calling you bitches, and, you know, you running, stocking, leg wearing, and so on, so on, so on, so on, so on, so on. In the middle of the cafeteria, you know, this is kind of thing that went on, and all I could think of was, as long as you don't put your hands on me. Well, there was one day, and just to give you a little history of my disposition coming through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, this girl who would do that often, every morning when I get ready to get on the public transportation or go to school. This one day, she felt bold enough, because she was hugged up with her boyfriend like this. She took her foot. She seen me walking by with my cute little shoes with no back, and little, you know, toes out and everything. It was summertime, and I was all dolled up. Well, she kicked me. Like, she did it on accident. But it hit me with such force that I knew it wasn't. That was the first time I had a blackout. I blacked the fuck out on that bitch. You know? I don't remember much other than saying, bitch. And she's like, who you calling a bitch? That bitch was up under my arm, and I was trying to kill her. And even after the fight, I thought, damn, why did I throw her ass out in the street? You know, that type of stuff. You know, I'm one of those people who's really sweet at heart. Until you piss me off. You know, people thought I was shy. Didn't have any real personality. But that just wasn't the truth. Hell, I cracked me up a lot. And still to this day, I make me laugh. You know, people think I'm on the phone. But the fact of the matter is, I'm a people watcher. I've always watched people. You know, whether it be, okay, I know she don't like me, this is how I'm going to handle her. Because I wasn't much of a talker at all. So all I knew is, yeah, I'm going to throw the first punch. You know, that type of stuff. That was my mentality. Because I was a small girl. So I wasn't a big girl. So, people would try me often. So now that I got graduated from high school, you know, who really thinks, you know, I'm going to be an alcoholic when I grow up? Even if I have an alcoholic family, even if they're dysfunctional, that was not my thoughts, by no means. I wanted to be a social worker, which was strange because I didn't like people worth a damn. You know, but I couldn't think of any other major that might be easy other than social work. I'm like, well, you know, social work, I should be able to get through with social work, you know? But I remember being in tears trying to register because nobody guided me through the process. I remember trying to fill out those FAFSAs and all of that stuff, you know. And when I finally got up to the registrar's office to hopefully get my classes, and they told me I had some more shit to do. Oh, my God. I mean, it just started coming down, you know. So I had a lot of experiences. And today, hindsight, I realized that God was preparing me for something great. I wasn't a drinker long. Why? Because I was a blackout drinker. Couldn't remember shit. You know? But when people would tell me what the fuck I did, I was like, who was that? That was you. You know, you girl, we couldn't get you to keep your clothes on to save our life. Every time we'd send you back upstairs, you had to take your clothes off. You know, and I was like, ugh, how embarrassing. And then I would wake up to evidence of my drinking. You know, and this particular time, I kind of remember. Now, I blacked my eye twice. Okay, tripping over stuff, falling over things, whatever. But I remember my eye, when I came to, my eye, the same eye was purple. And this one day, I was at a nightclub by myself, because I spent a lot of time by myself. I had on this really short skirt. And I was hugging the light pole, you know, just trying, because I had these real high heels on, just to keep me from falling over. So the police saw me there, and they decided, and mind you, I'm underage, because I didn't come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous until I was 20. So I had a fake ID, of course. So the police picked me up, and they said, they decided they're going to be nice, and they're going to take me home, right? Okay. I was sitting in the back of the car, and all I could hear is all these jokes about my situation, how funny I looked. You know, it wasn't, oh, poor baby. You know, she's so young, we don't want anything to happen to her. It wasn't that. You know, it was funny as hell to them, right? And I heard all of it. So I didn't go home. I went over to my cousin's house. They lived in the projects. And I knew that I could come in there and not get my ass whooped. So they let me out the car. And I got to the point where, you know, the the lights of the car was shining on me real good, and I stuck on my middle finger. And when I turned around, just to show you how karma is, I tripped over the parking rail and hit my face on the hard concrete. So that morning, when I woke up and saw my eye purple, I knew what happened. I remembered that because I remember the stars, you know, when I hit the ground, you know. So that was one incident. And then on top of it, I tried to get a job with this black eye. I don't know which black eye it was. I can't tell you because a lot of my drinking kind of ran together. So if you want dates and all that stuff, I don't have those. All I know is that I tried to get a job as a TSA at the airport. And it was great hours now. You know, I worked the midnight shift. So I can go to the party, and then I could go to work. You know, no problems. I could sleep all day if I wanted to. Cool. You know, I thought that was the best job. But if I had to jump on somebody, I could just whoop their ass on GP. You know what I'm saying? Just because. And that was wonderful for me. The lady who interviewed me looked at me and she said, "I'm going to hire you. But if you bring your ass back in here with another black eye, I'm going to fire you." And see, the funny thing about it, I knew that she thought that it was domestic violence. And it wasn't. You know, it was violence on myself. But it was not because somebody hit me. And I let her believe that, you know, it was domestic violence. So that's kind of an idea of how things went in the beginning. Now, somewhere in the interim, I crossed the invisible line, and I started to black out. Now, mind you, my drink was Old English 800. I would get the nice tall cans, and all I needed was two. And I wasn't an everyday drinker. You know, I drank pretty much on special occasions, holidays, things of that nature. Something comes up, I throw up, but I go and I show up. So I wasn't a heavy drinker. So the thought of me being an alcoholic, mind you, never occurred to me. You know, I didn't remind me of my mom or my dad because I didn't get like, well, first of all, I didn't have any responsibilities. I didn't have any kids. You know, at this juncture, I didn't have a job because I didn't need a job. The first time I remember thinking about God is before I was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis. And what I learned is that I cannot take care of me, and other people really couldn't take care of me either. For whatever reason, they couldn't. You know, people was in disbelief that something was wrong with me. They just thought I was lazy. You know, I was so lazy that I couldn't walk. I was so lazy that I couldn't open a bottle of milk. I was so lazy I couldn't comb my hair or wash my ass or any the other things the normal people did. This was at the age of 19. And I thought, you know, God, it's just me and you. And I knew nothing. I knew nothing about this program. I knew it exists, but I just didn't think that I qualified. So I'm going to go into, yes, I went to jail for disorderly conduct. You know, I did try to whoop on a few big girls. And I was this big, mind you. So there was parties that I had went to, and people had to throw me over their shoulder just to keep me from, you know, getting in any more trouble than I was already in. Let me tell you one funny story before I go into the solution. This funny story here, I said, this is the first time I said I wasn't going to drink. And I said, I'm not going to have none of that punch. Nope, I'm not. No, I'm not. And me and my cousin was sitting back. We was talking because it was an engagement party. And we were talking about the guy that this girl wanted to marry. And we thought, oh my God, what was she thinking? She needs glasses. He was fucked up. You know? And we chuckled in the corner about it, right? And continued to try to dance and have a good time about it. Well, somewhere in the interim, I thought it would be a good idea to at least have one cup of punch. Well, that one cup of punch led me into being thrown over my cousin's shoulder. I had one eyeglass lens in my eyeglasses. And I was the driver because I'm the only one who had a car. And nobody could drive it because it was a stick shift. So, come to find out, the reason why I was fighting or about to fight was because I grabbed this girl's fiance on the ass. The same dude I said was fucked up. What the hell was he thinking? You know, they said I grabbed his ass. I'm like, no, I couldn't have. They said, yeah, you did. You know, so, you know, my last drink was what they call it, incomprehensible demoralization. Because although I did some things, I had some standards. But this particular night it hurt me to the core. I had I had made meetings for 6 months. And I looked around and I saw all these old people. And I thought, oh, hell no. I jumped the gun on this one. You know, because there is no way that I belong here.
Yeah.
And so I said, and you know, matter of fact, I don't have any urges to drink. So I thought, you know, the reason why I made the meetings, because they were safe. When my family and other people around me, my friends would turn up, I would go to a meeting. Because I didn't want to hear another story about what I did, how you fell out the chair with that gin and bust my eye again. I didn't want to hear those stories. I just didn't want to hear them. So this night, I remember getting in the car. And I was the driver, of course. And my first drink, they talk about that ease and comfort. Well, that's what I felt, that ease and comfort. But I couldn't remember the shit off stuff for the ease and comfort. I don't even remember pulling off. They talk about how when we go out there, it gets worse. Never better. Oh my God, I don't remember it. But what I do remember is when I came to the next morning, I was told that I had a car accident, tore my car, and I had this older woman cussing me out because I was in the bed with my boyfriend's brother. And I thought, how the fuck am I going to get out of here? So I did get out of there in tears, and I thought, the funny thing is, I asked them, do you think I'm an alcoholic? They drank drink like I did.
Hell no, you're not an alcoholic.
You know, so I took that word for it, but deep in my heart, I knew it was something wrong with me. So after that might have been the day that I called my mom, because she had been sober for at least maybe 8 or 9 years at the time, because she has 9 years more than I do. And I said, what if those meetings that you make don't work? And she said, well, you know, some people go to treatment. And I said, okay, treatment. I can do that. I can do treatment, yeah. You know, because at the time I was on disability. I was getting a check. I had insurance. You know, I didn't have to worry about a job. I was staying with my dad at the time. Don't have no kids. I didn't have no responsibilities. Cool, I can do this. So I get treatment. Now, mind you, my drug of choice was alcohol. And it's not like I did, like my fiancé say, the cousins. I did those two. But my drug of choice was alcohol because it was more acceptable, I thought, you know. So, and cheaper, you know, and more people had it. And I didn't have to worry about being raided. things of that nature. You know, I was a chicken shit when that jail shit happened, you know. So when I went to treatment, oh my God, these people did some things to me that I never thought anybody would do to me. They didn't even do this to me in jail. I mean, they went through taking my socks off, looking between my toes, making me bend over with no clothes on, and stuff like that. And I thought, what the fuck did I get myself into? You know, these people crazy. You know, I got in there, and it was so nice in there. It was clean. You know, because I got sober in Chicago. I don't remember the name of the place. That's the one thing I don't remember. But I did, it was ATC, something. But anyway, I was there, and they fed me well. You know, I didn't bother to try to mess with the girls too much, because a lot of them didn't have any teeth, or they were missing. They looked hard. They looked real hard. Like somebody had really did them a job, you know. So I didn't fuck with them, straight up. You know, I'm minding my own damn business. I didn't hear much in the meetings when I went those 6 months, because all I could think of is how different I was from everybody else. I thought I was unique. And, so, I thought I was unique, and, you know, people would say things to me like, what you doing here? You're barely legal, you know, and I started to believe that shit. You know, I was like, yeah, you're right. You know, I'm barely legal. But when I picked up that drink, I picked it up when I was 21. It was on my birthday. And all I know is that feeling that I had was, you talk about self-loathing, guilt, remorse, shame, all that. Because I didn't even like boy brothers. You know what I'm saying? None. He thought that I was cute, but the feeling was not mutual. You know, so I got into treatment, but what I heard in treatment was an allergy. You know, it was an obsession of the mind and an allergy of the body. Aha! That was my first thought. That was the only thing I heard. All I know is that food was good. You know what I'm saying? I got fat.
He put on a few pounds. I started to look kind of nice and everything. I didn't pay those girls no attention who was in the hallway trying to get with the guys upstairs. You know what I'm saying? That was not my business. I really didn't care. The way I felt about men when I came to the program was that they took advantage of me when I was under the influence. And I didn't want no part of that shit. So when they started to tell me about not picking up men, I had no problem with that. Because there was a girl who was in the halfway house who was so damn cute. And she had this dude who had this sharp-ass car. And she was really popular. But then she didn't finish the program because she got gang raped. And I thought, You know what I'm saying? And like I said, I'm a people watcher. So I watch people all the time. I didn't say shit too much. I'm not a talker. I'm one of those people that, you know, just touch me. Just touch me, okay? And it's all like for a flesh stone, okay? But I got out of treatment. I didn't set a sobriety date. And the reason why I didn't, because I got sober in 90, December of 90. Before the holidays, it started to jump off real good or whatever, I was in treatment. I got, 15 minutes or 5 minutes?
10 minutes.
10 minutes? Okay, now we're going to make it happen now, y'all. So, once I got out of treatment, I knew I didn't want to go back to my dad's house. I knew that wasn't going to happen. Because he's an alcoholic. He's the same person who was calling me bitches and hoes and so on and so forth when his friends was around and all of that good stuff. He was the number one offender for me. We were the ones fighting all the time. We didn't fight with belts. We fought with fists. I tried to kick him in his balls. You know, yeah, I tried to do him damage before I climbed out the window and ran away. So he wasn't somewhere I wanted to go back to. My mom lived out of state. And the blessing in that was my mom never said anything about my alcoholism. Because she's had so many people in her life die from alcoholism. After she came in the program and said, hey, you might have a problem. And you know what they said? Fuck you. You know. And so she didn't want to tell me because she didn't want me to do the same. She said if I tell Lynette, she's not going to listen. She's going to do the opposite. So that was probably true for the most part. And I'm so glad she didn't. But what she did do, she prayed for me. And today I realized how important prayer is. Now we're going to jump off into step 1, 2, and 3. Step 1. I was powerless over alcohol. My life was unmanageable. I didn't have shit to lose, so that wasn't my issue. That was the part that I thought was different when I came to meetings, because I heard people losing their wives, their jobs, their this, their that, you know, the relationships with the kids, all that. I didn't lose anything like that. I lost my self-respect. I lost my self-esteem. I lost any kind of goals. I lost those things. You know, all those intangible things. My car, of course, I lost that too. But that really didn't count at the time. I really didn't think about that too much. So I knew my life was unmanageable. And as we know, the step 1 and step 2 are reflective steps. So I didn't need a sponsor for that. You know, when I walked in the door, I was as willing as the day I can be. I really was. I was so hurt. Couldn't nobody beat me up more than I beat up myself. So I sat in the back of the room a lot, and I would listen. And there's an art to listening, and I listened, and I listened, and I listened. And in Chicago, they were good for telling you to sit the fuck down and shut the fuck up. You know nothing about recovery. And for me, I sat my ass down and I shut the fuck up. Because I just didn't want nobody to know anything about me. I didn't want them to know what I did and how shameful I was about it. I didn't want nobody to know anything. So I shut up and I sat back. And I did that for 15 years. Now, mind you, there was a time in between, though, in my second year, that I did try to talk because I was a Bible thumper for the first 3 years of my sobriety. And I knew that in these rooms, I knew enough because I went to book studies that we talk about God. So I thought I could talk about God. I didn't talk about Jesus Christ as Lord. I didn't talk about, you know, Buddha or, you know, chanting. I didn't talk about none of that. I talked about the God that I was growing to understand. And an old timer pulled me to the side and told me, this is not a religious program. And I said, religious? I don't know nothing about religion. I was just talking about the God that I was growing to understand through the people in these rooms. So I thought, you know, he's an old timer. Why would he tell me this shit? Okay. That was my first experience with not knowing enough about the literature and having more information about the fellowship than the actual program. Then there was step two, the insanity. You know, my mom would always say, well, you know, the insanity is live separate and apart from God. And that stuck to me like glue. Because when I wanted to kill myself when I was 9, I had no God. And when I asked my grandmother, who used to drag me to church, how do you get saved? Well, baby, when you get there, you'll know it. That was not the answer. When a child asks you a question just as important as that, you can give them a lot more than that. And I wish he had them, because I think that would have changed the course of my life. Step three. Turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood them. Well, you know, I thought that was a loophole. Because, first of all, I didn't understand God. And it was underlined that, you know, you have to understand, have some understanding of this God, right? And I'm like, that's my drinking words right there. You know what I'm saying? Because I don't think I'm going to make this program because of that. But what ended up happening is that I prayed and God put the right people in my life. And I asked this lady, because it was a lady in the train station. She was like, okay, does anybody want to do a Bible study? And I said, is this like a group thing? And she was like, no, it's a one-on-one. I was like, perfect. I have a lot of questions about this guy that we're talking about. And so I did that. And she ended up being my first sponsor. I was able to tell her any and everything. And she was able to show me in the book. She taught me how to read my Bible. That's why I was a Bible thumper. I learned that book before I got really able to learn the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I'm going to say this. When I read that book, when people would talk about God around the rooms, I could put a thumbs up because I read it in the Bible. So I could concur, you know. And that felt really good, you know, because I knew I was in the right place, in the right space. You know, I never had any notions of leaving Alcoholics Anonymous for the church, because I knew that this was the milk that was going to get me to that solid food that was church. I wasn't religious. It was a non-denominational church. I was growing into some spirituality. Turning my will, which was my thinking, and my actions, which was, you know, my life, over to something other than myself. And I wasn't trying to fit in anymore with nobody. You know, I wasn't trying to be like, you know, Susie Lynn, because she had a nice walk. I wasn't trying to be like, oh, girl who has pretty long hair. You know, I wasn't trying to be like anybody. And my self-esteem grew. But the book says that self-confidence is nothing. So I knew it wasn't that. But I started to be happy in a way that I never really been happy. My mom would tell you that I was pretty much flatlined. You know, she didn't say it in those words, but she, you know, she was like, you know, you don't get excited too much, do you? You know, and I didn't really, no. And I'm grateful that I learned a lot about this program. And one thing I want to share, at 31 years, there's, when you get step six, I'm going to share this. It might step off some people's toes, but that's okay. I'm going to read this, and I'm going to let you know. This should say a lot about where I am spiritually and where I'm still going spiritually. Because this is a lifetime journey. It's not a sprint. It's a journey. And here on in step six, when it talks about separating, you know, this is the step to separate the boys from the men. You know, I was like, that sounds good. Separate the boys from the men. Well, anyway, it talked about, we're not going to talk about no, never, I would never give this up. No, never, I would not change this. And some of these character defects I like too much got me what I wanted. Well, anyway, when I got around here, progress was great, you know, but after a few years, progress wasn't enough. And when I read step six, it concurred. I'm going to read this one paragraph and I'm going to shut up. On page 67, it says, some people, of course, may conclude that they are in be ready to have all their defects taken from them. But even these people, if they constructed a list of still milder defects, will be obliged to admit that they prefer to hang on to some of them. Therefore, it seemed plain that few of us can quickly or easily become ready to aim at spiritual and moral perfection. We wanted to settle for only as much perfection as would get us by in life. Of course, to our various and sundry ideas of what will get us by. So, the difference between the boys and the men is the difference between striving for self-determined objectives and for perfect objective, which is God. And I read that, and the reason why I read that is because now I understand why they say a lot of things in the big book. Like, these are, you know, these are suggestions. They are suggestions. But just like if you jump out of a plane, it's suggested that you pull the ripcord. You don't have to. So if you want to live, it's a must. And so they have a lot of musts in this book. And this right here, progress rather than perfection, was wonderful. And I needed that when I came around. But when you get a little time, progress is not enough. I had to strive for something higher, something that's going to get me to working my ass off when I get some time. And I never get it now. I never be perfect. But if I strive for that perfect objective, which is God, I always have something to work on. And today I've always been busy. Service, love, patience, and tolerance, sponsoring people. I've had some turmoil, some bumpy times. I've had the acid test and all that. But I'm grateful today that I'm in this program. I could not wish for anything better. And I keep coming back. Thanks. Woo!
Thank you.
that was a treat. I asked your friend to come up and hand out the chips.
Hey, family, will it be grateful alcoholic? Now, she only told y'all a part of the story. I'll get a piece of it on the way home tonight, and about 1 o'clock tonight, okay? And then some more tomorrow. She's going to be chatty as hell tonight. I can tell when she gets chatty. We've been together too long. Okay, what am I doing here? Okay, doing the chips. Again, Willie B. Grateful Alcoholic.
Hey, Willie B.
And here at, what's the name of the girl?
Blue Chip Speaker Meeting.
And I got to speak next month. Here at Blue Chip Speaker Meeting, we have a chip system, which denotes the amount of time that you have and not necessarily the quality. That is up to you and your God of your understanding. So without further ado, I'm going to call out the chips. White chip, anybody here coming in okay for the first time? We have a 30-day chip, which I'm going to have some glasses on. Think before you drink. Yep. And on the other side, it has the Serenity Prayer. I don't know. It's too small. I ain't seen one of these in a minute. 30 days. Anybody?
All right. All right.
Six days. Woo! Get my hugs in tonight. Any more 30s? I mean 60s? See? I gotta keep coming back. That's why I came in these rooms. I'm crazy as hell. Alright. Red chip. 90 days. 90. Come on now. Eyes, maybe still some of bloodshot, but they're getting better. Anybody? I know my bloodshot, so. 90? No? All right. Put that down. 6 months. Yellow. Ain't nothing yellow about it. Yellow again. That means your piss is getting clearer. And it don't stink either. All right, 9 months. A little grass between you and the liquor store, and you got a little money in your pocket today. Yeah. Even if it ain't for $2, at least you ain't spending it on nothing to drink. Anybody? 9 months? All right, and the infamous blue chip. 1 year of more. Okay. Do we have any more blue chips? All right. Give yourself a hand and God of your understanding. Thank you, God. Oh, and I'm going to leave this white chip for some of y'all. Y'all know y'all steal. So I'm going to leave that
right here. Thank you one and all for joining the Blue Chip Speakers Meeting tonight.
Somewhere strange to me.
town. Can't put the bottle down. Right now feels like it's killing me. Life out here gets so depressing. Need something to take the edge, you see. It's the Bible, the book, or the girl for me. Seems like everyone's out to get me. Trouble always following me. Feeling like I just can't outrun. Demons that are all around me. The girl.